following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hi, everybody. Coming up, Nicole tells your fortune, looking ahead. So get out your crystal and stay tuned with Mistress Nicole. All dressed in leather, you won't forget her. You want to love her and you won't let go. Who's that woman, crazy woman, Nicole?
I thought we'd change up the intro for a Friday, you know, because we can. That, in case you're thinking, but that voice sounds familiar. Who could that be singing that song? That's Chris Isaak. You know, Wicked Game, Chris Isaak? Yeah, him. I got another one. I could go back and forth. I could also start with this one.
Okay. Rock,
rock, rockin' Nicole. Yeah. Everybody rock, sing.
Rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Oh, once she grabs, she won't let go. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
None of that soft stuff.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
None of that heavy metal stuff.
Rock, rock. Rockin' Nicole.
Just a little bit of jazz.
Rockin' Nicole.
What do you think?
Just
I
like
love
that.
It. Yeah, that was great. Thank you.
There you go. So we kick off a Friday.
Big laughs out of the hall.
With Chris Isaak and Kenny Dale Johnson there. Welcome to it. It is a Friday. I changed things up a little bit today. So usually what happens is, you know, we hit the air on the Progressive Voices Network at 5 p.m. Eastern sharp. I play pre-show music. I play a bed because sometimes the clocks are not quite synchronized. But, and then I was playing What's News after the show at the end. And then, a friend suggested, why not do What's News leading into the show? So if people come in early, they hear that. So we tried that today. We'll see. It's I'm trying things because we can. Anyway, welcome to a Friday. I'm glad this week is over. I don't know about you. I'm excited for the weekend. I'm going to go see David and I have tickets, finally, to see the immersive Van Gogh. There are a few different touring virtual reality kind of all-inclusive, all-immersive Van Gogh exhibits traveling around the world. So we're going to go on Saturday. I will give you a full review next week. But yes, I will be wearing a mask. And if you don't wear a mask, if you go out and you're around other people and you're not wearing a mask right now, then you deserve what you get. Same with if you're not vaccinated. Now, if you're not vaccinated and don't wear a mask, what is wrong with you? New cases are surging. In fact, I know I had some... statistics here. Where did I put him here? I don't know where I put. I keep notes. I've got notes everywhere around here, in just case you were wondering. But not only are they surging everywhere, one in five new cases in the past week from Florida. Yeah, baby. So a little later on in the hour, we're going to get into the vaccination thing. But I'm going to start with the more serious stuff. Well, the vaccination stuff is serious too. But we're going to start with what's going on in Cuba. That's something that I haven't really talked about here. And the rest of the country may not be as affected by it, but here in South Florida, we certainly are. I mean, I refer to Miami as North Cuba because, well, since 1980, since the Mariel boat lift, Miami is, it's a suburb of Havana, I guess. So, you know, when I go to Miami, I feel like I'm in a different country because English is not the main language in Miami. Spanish is spoken everywhere. Now, we'll be in Miami tomorrow because that's where this Van Gogh thing is. So, you know, you have to listen with two ears because everything's in Spanish and occasionally you get English too. But what I'm going to tell you about here, it has nothing to do with that. You may recall, you know, we have a governor, the guy who's being touted as the next Republican great hope for president, because, you know, Trump's not going to run And if he does run, he'll lose. But they're now embracing moron death sentence. Can you believe it? This guy is, the name fits him. It's Ron DeSantis, you know that. But moron death sentence just works. So back last summer, after the Black Lives Matter protests, which, by the way, there were plenty of them down here in Florida, none of them turned violent. None of them were riots. They were peaceful protests. But some people marched in the streets. In fact, I remember being somewhere and there was a march going on. Oh, you know what? That was the Women's March. Never mind. But when they closed down the highway. But the point I'm trying to make here unsuccessfully is that there were, so Ron DeSantis got this bill passed. He signed into law a law, an anti-riot law, they called it, that says that people cannot block the streets with protests. So let me just read to you a little bit. This is not even from the Miami Herald. This is from the Washington Post about what happened earlier in the week here in Miami. Scores of people crowded a major Miami area highway Tuesday, chanting in support of rare protests that erupted days earlier in Cuba against the country's communist government. The rally, now here's the important part, the rally caused an hours-long closure on part of the Palmetto Expressway in Miami-Dade County. Palmetto is one of the worst roads in rush hour traffic. It's stop and go, and they shut it down. But back to the Washington Post. It was the sort of scene envisioned by a divisive Florida law that the governor pushed amid last year's wave of racial justice demonstrations. The legislation calls for protesters to be cited if they block traffic. But no citations were given Tuesday, according to state and local law enforcement. Critics took issue with the lack of citations, saying the law is unclear or unevenly applied. Death Sentence, who invoked the possibility of protesters shutting down a highway as he signed the bill into law, has been vocal in his support of rallies against the Cuban government. Asked about the Palmetto Expressway protest during a Tuesday roundtable with reporters, and then they shut it down, just so you know, they shut down the Palmetto Expressway. DeSantis said that the recent demonstrations were, quote, fundamentally different than last summer's protests that had inspired the law. You know what I have to say to that, don't you?
Bullshit.
Right. There was no difference. They were both peaceful protests. The anti-rioting law that he signed after the protests that followed the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis says that a person is committing a riot if, quote, he or she willfully participates in a violent public disturbance involving an assembly of three or more people. Three or more people. The measure also increases the penalties for any violence, burglary, looting, or property damage during protests. But under the law, anyone arrested on unlawful assembly charges must be held without bail until a first appearance in court. And a person shall be cited for a pedestrian violation if they, quote, willfully obstruct the free, convenient, and normal use of a public street, highway, or road. So this protest where the people protesting the Cuban government were guilty of it. Not only was nobody arrested or cited, given a ticket, the cops shut down the Palmetto Expressway so they could march. So DeSantis, when he was signing the law, he said this, quote, just think about it. You're driving home from work and all of a sudden you have people out there shutting down a highway. And we worked hard to make sure that didn't happen in Florida. They start to do that, then there needs to be swift penalties. What? So critics of the law questioned Death Sentence's political aims when arguing it didn't apply to the people protesting the Cuban government. You see, Cuban exiles are a huge voting bloc for the Republican Party here in South Florida. So hypocrisy much? Hypocrisy? Governor Death Sentence? Yeah, this is where we are. So that's all going on. So, you know, I had some questions about what's going on in Cuba. And so I decided to call in an expert. Let's do that first. And then we'll come back on the other side of my conversation with Anthony DePalma and we'll get into the vaccination stuff. But first, everybody should know what's happening in Cuba, because honestly, it's historic. Something is going on that we've seen maybe twice before in the last 60 years. So with no further ado, let's talk to our guest. Let me bring him in. His name is Anthony De Palma. Anthony De Palma is an author and a journalist who was a foreign correspondent for the New York Times for 22 years. His latest book is Cubans, Ordinary Lives in Extraordinary Times. And on Tuesday, he had an op-ed published in the Washington Post titled, As in 1994, Cubans Protest Against a Regime's Mortal Threat. Anthony, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be here with you. Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you. And I'm in South Florida, so I have a unique perspective on what's happening with Cuba. We've seen in recent days highways closed down with protesters marching in solidarity with the people still in Cuba, something that we haven't seen in a while, although Miami does seem to explode with people in the streets every time something big happens in Cuba. But why don't you tell what's going on there right now?
Yeah, well, it is something big. That's what's happening in Cuba now. Protest in Cuba has, for the 62 years since the revolution, really been almost non-existent. There was an explosion in 1994. We can talk about that later, but there's a big difference between then and now. In 1994, economic conditions were really bad. Right. This was in the lowest point of what they called the special period in time of peace. Nothing special about it. It was awful. Mm-hmm. There was no food. There was no medicine. There was no transportation. There was no electricity most of the day and night. Instead of talking about a blackout, they made up a word for the periods of time when there was electricity. Wow. So imagine living in Cuba in July on the 10th floor of a building without an elevator or air conditioning.
Ooh.
So things were really bad. And thousands came out on the seawall, the Malecón, and were saying things like libertad, freedom, which is what you're hearing now, mm-hmm. and what until that point was almost unheard of in public, down with Fidel.
Wow. Yes.
Fidel showed up in the afternoon, and mysteriously, the crowd changed from down with Fidel to Viva la Revolución, right? In Cuba, most people only saw that scene. They saw the scene of Fidel showing up and basically the crowd dispersing. None of the behind the scene people with sticks and the policemen and all of that other repressive mechanism. Today, what you're seeing is people out in the street, not just in Havana, but in cities across the country, even in Santiago de Cuba, which is like the heart of the revolution. And people all over Cuba are seeing that, right? Because every time there's somebody in the street, there's somebody behind her or him with a cell phone,
right,
streaming it live. And so what that does is, to understand a little bit more about what's happening in Cuba, and many of your people already know that down there, but if there's anybody listening from outside, two real characteristics of Cubans are, one, their adaptability. They can accommodate almost any hardship, and that's how they've survived over 62 years of a revolution that never ends. But accommodating hardship means you're not demanding change. Why not demand change? Well, when you have so little, and you know that if you protest, there's not going to be anybody behind you, you don't want to risk losing the little bit that you have in a quest for something that's never going to happen. But once you have those streaming videos and people know that, well, I know that everybody else is angry, but now I know that they're also out there with me, then you break down the fear. So it really is an indication that Cubans are becoming less fearful. And that, Nicole, that is something that the government really needs to be afraid of.
Now this is
not our government, their government.
Right. Now, this is the first time in history since Cuba has been in 62 years that there hasn't been a Castro in charge. So Fidel finally died. Raul had taken over. And then a couple of years ago, he stepped down. Who's in charge now? And is there a big difference, or is it just, you know, things have carried on?
Oh, absolutely. Very important point. Raul stepped down in 2018 mm-hmm. as president, but he remained head of the party. And the Communist Party is the ultimate law in Cuba. In April, just a couple of weeks ago, he retired as head of the party.
Ah.
So this is happening almost immediately on the heels of him leaving Havana and going into some happy retirement down in wherever he is. The man that he picked, he and Fidel picked together to take over, is this bland bureaucrat, really, Miguel Díaz-Canel, who could never, ever, no matter who they picked, could never live up to the mythology of Fidel and Raul, you know, being up in the mountains, young right. guys, taking over a whole country. They were only in their early 30s, right. and they took over the country in the 1960s.
Yep.
So this guy had an impossible task, but they thought that by getting a bureaucrat who was steeped in the whole system and had everything to gain by continuing it and everything to lose by changing it, they thought that they were safe in continuing. So it's interesting, when Raul stepped down in April as head of the party, and so that for the first time meant there was no Castro in charge,
right.
you would think that that meant after 60 years that we'd be talking about change. But the message from Havana was, don't think of this as change. This is continuity. And so there were banners out on the street of José Martí, right, the apostle of Cuba, Fidel, Raul, and then next to him, the new guy, Díaz-Canel. The message clearly was, don't expect anything to change. That didn't go down well with people who were standing online for 5 hours to get a pound of chicken. People who couldn't get a COVID shot were stuck waiting online with other people all crowded around them when they know that they're supposed to be separated, when there's no electricity because Venezuela is cutting the oil imports to Cuba, and the sanctions that the Trump administration put on, including, very importantly, limits on the amount of money that Americans could send their families in Cuba, remittances, that has really hurt. Because also in January, they combined the currency. So they got rid of the crazy fake currency that they had, and they allow Cubans to actually hold dollars.
Wow.
Except that there are no dollars coming in, because there are limits on the remittances and all tourism is shut down.
Well, that's
so bad situation.
Right. Now that's the next thing I wanted to ask you about, because during the Obama administration, he tried to normalize relations with Cuba, opened the border, sort of. I know people were traveling, you know, it wasn't totally open, but people were able to go from the U.S. to Cuba for the first time in many, many years. And then Trump came in and said, no, we're reversing it. If not for Trump, would things have gotten better? Were they getting better? And was it reversed? Or so how did Trump's taking over the presidency change the progress that was happening in Cuba?
Yeah, well, I mean, the two primary sources of foreign currency for Cuba are tourism and a combination of these remittances from, not only from the United States, there are a lot of Cubans who have family in Spain right. and in Mexico, and they all send in money. But there were limits on the amount of money that Americans could send. And there was also a campaign against Cuba's policy of sending out doctors to other countries, right? It's very complicated, but basically Cuba trains more doctors than it needs. There are thousands and thousands of Cuban doctors. What the government does is offer to send them. For instance, they sent Cuban doctors to Italy at the beginning of the pandemic. Italy pays for the doctor services, but they pay the Cuban government. And the Cuban government then takes about 75 to 80% of it.
Of course they do.
Which in terms of international labor is like a form of slavery. So the Trump State Department really came down hard on it with its allies in other countries, particularly Brazil, They canceled those contracts. So that was another source of foreign currency that was shut down. So those things altogether, and Brazil did it, you know, with the support or solidarity of the Trump administration, you know, that right. connection there. So that really had an impact. But to answer your question directly, yes, the Trump sanctions hurt, but Cuba would still be in a bad way because of COVID,
right.
shutting down the tourism industry, and because of the problems in Venezuela. Venezuela is the primary source of oil that Cuba uses to generate electricity and to fuel its transport system. Venezuela is having a hard time, so they have decreased substantially the amount of oil that they send to Cuba, which means that you go hours without electricity, and to get around Cuba was always difficult. Now, the people that I talk to down there say it's almost impossible. Plus, things are shut down because of COVID, so all around, they tell me it gets more difficult every day.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the doctors, that they've got an abundance of doctors, but at the same time, the hospitals and facilities are crumbling. So they may have the talent there, but they don't have the infrastructure. And obviously the sanctions and everything are not helping. So, so the protests, this is something new in the internet age. The last time you mentioned around 94, there was some action. And I don't know if before that, I mean, I'm old enough that I remember I was living in South Florida at the time, around 1980 with the Mariel boatlift. That's when Miami became like Little Havana. It turned the whole face of South Florida into a refuge for Cuban immigrants, Sorry. People who left Cuba. But the protests didn't happen. And you mentioned it's the internet. Well, now, once this round of protests started, they cut off the internet on the island. I understand it's back now. Is it back fully or in limited access? Or what's the situation today?
It's back. Parts of it are back. It's spotty. The service is very slow. So that means it's difficult to upload or download anything. Mm-hmm. But remember what I said before about the trait of Cubans, the characteristic, which is their adaptability. Well, as I've been trying to get messages down there and messages back, I find out that Cubans have already, in just this past week, found workarounds. Huh. They've got ways to get around the census. They've got ways to get around the blockade. Of the internet. So they're still sending out messages and sending out their videos. It's not the way it was before, but I don't think you can put this genie back in the bottle. The country is run basically by old men.
Mm-hmm.
There are, although Raul, who's now 90, has retired, there are guys who were with him on the Granma, the boat that came in 1956, who are still in the government.
Wow.
And they're still marching around in their military uniforms. They're 90, 91 years old. It's ridiculous. It's worse than seeing Tommy Lasorda in a Los Angeles Dodgers baseball uniform, right? Managers shouldn't have to wear the uniforms. Right. It looks silly.
Yes.
But here are these guys, 90 years old, dressing in their military uniforms,
right.
being saluted and told general. I don't think they really clearly understood what it meant to open up the internet services. Now, the Cubans that I know were really excited 2 years ago because they were getting 3G service.
Uh-huh.
3G.
Right.
Right. We're now into 5G and beyond. Yeah. But what 3G service meant, even in the limited way, was that those cameras, which somehow they can get, there might be an embargo, but a lot of people have cameras, smartphones, they can use them to stream out in the street. And that has changed everything. And I think that's taken the guys in charge by surprise. So how are they reacting? What are they going to do? Well, the president, Diaz-Canel, is no Fidel. So he tried going down to the place where the first protest started. Mm-hmm. And he basically had no impact. So he had to then come back and go on TV. And you could see his paranoia and nervousness. And basically, he issued a call to arms, basically telling them, the Cuban people who were watching. And remember, the only TV is state TV. There's no other alternative.
Right.
Telling them that the people out in the street were mercenaries, delinquents, and tools of the imperialist. And so it's the role of true revolutionaries to go out and clear the streets, basically saying the only way we're going to give up is over our dead bodies. Well, it was an invitation to violence. And yeah. I think it showed how insecure he is and the difference between how it was handled in the past and now. So I think Washington has to be careful, because you mentioned 1980 and the boat lift.
Yes.
And 1994, they responded by opening up the borders, and 35,000 Cubans left in little rafts. That was the Balsero crisis. Their only response is to basically open the relief valve and let the people who were angriest get out.
Right.
So right now you saw Mayorkas, the head of Homeland Security, issue a warning telling Cubans and Haitians — they're having trouble in Haiti.
Oh, yes,
Haiti,
they are.
Well, yeah. Don't try to come by water, because we're going to turn you around, which is basically the same thing they said in 94. But there were so many people, they ended up being picked up by the U.S. Coast Guard and brought to Guantanamo. And then from Guantanamo, negotiating with Fidel, they all were brought to the United States. So that's what you have to look forward to right now. And I think Washington must be busy as anything trying to figure out how to do it.
Wow.
My recommendation to them would be to lift the limit on those remittances, at least temporarily during the COVID crisis, and say, look, we're going to allow Americans right now to send as much money as they want to Cubans, because Cubans need those dollars in order to buy stuff that in the Cuban stores that take the Cuban peso, there's almost nothing. But they have set up stores that accept dollars, and there you can find a lot, but nobody has dollars.
Oh, wow.
So if you did that, it would be compassionate. It would be humanitarian. It would directly help the Cuban people. And it might get us into some sort of negotiation or some sort of talk. President Biden promised during the campaign that he would reverse those sanctions. He hasn't done it yet. I think what happened last week is probably going to push it way up. His spokesperson said Cuba wasn't a priority.
Right.
But I think now it probably is.
Right. And as recently as yesterday, they were saying Cuba's not a priority, but it's got to be. And especially here in South Florida, we feel it. You know, we feel it daily. There's a policy that I think a lot of people around the rest of the country don't know. It's called wet foot, dry foot. And basically, it's interesting that you said they're telling them don't come by water. The policy now is, if they can make it to land, if they can set foot on Florida soil, you know, on the sand, then they're cool. They can come in. If they're caught out at sea, they're sent back. Is that still in force? That's the way it's been for so long.
It has, but Nicole, I have to correct you there.
Okay.
One of the very last things that President Obama did in his administration, mm-hmm. So it was the end of 2017 after the election, but right before Trump took over.
Yeah.
And I think it was December. And one of the last things he did was to end that policy.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Huh.
So it's not the case now. So individuals who are coming, if they're intercepted on the sea, they are sent back. If they are, they make it to land, they're detained.
Oh, I see.
They don't have the automatic process that they had before.
Okay.
But you can do that when there are hundreds of people attempting to make it to the United States, not when there are 35,000. So we are looking at, you know, the potential of a crisis unless this is resolved in some way. And you in South Florida will be the first ones to get impacted by it.
Well, of course. And now we have a governor who is a loose cannon. He's a nut. He's just crazy. And so I don't trust him for whatever he's going to do. First, he said he's going to, you know, beam in internet to the island. I don't know if that's possible or not, but he talks before he thinks. I don't know that he's capable of thinking. So that worries me of where we're going to go with this. So I guess we wait and see. Again, we're speaking with Anthony DePalma, who's been wrote for the New York Times as a foreign correspondent for 22 years. He's got a number of books, a few on Cuba, the latest, The Cubans, where you talk about individuals, like people who participated in the 94, I don't know, escape, I don't know what to call it, and how they fared. Many didn't make it, some did. You say the Cuban people are resilient, but will they be able to, do you think this is going to be a sea change? Do you think this is, you said you can't put the genie back in the bottle. Is this the next revolution?
Yeah. Nicole, I'm reluctant to consider this the beginning of a Cuban spring. What we saw, throughout the world in years past, where the people rise up and the government collapses.
Right.
The guys in the government who are running it now, mostly in the military, which has been well provided for. If you see any of the videos, keep this in mind. When you see the videos, you'll see the police on the street or the special police, the guys all in black. Uh-huh. Well, they're all fully dressed. They've got everything they need. So there's an embargo, but somehow those guys can get everything they need.
Right.
While the people that I deal with can't beg a single ibuprofen capsule. Every time I go, the number one request that I have is for ibuprofen.
Wow.
Ibuprofen, you go to Costco, they cost less than a penny a piece.
Right.
They're available everywhere, but not there. Those guys in charge have too much to lose by just giving up. They're not going to do it. And the people out in the street may have their phones and they have their voices and they can shout, we're not afraid, but they don't have the rest of what you need to sort of overtake a deeply entrenched, well-armed government. In other words, there are no guns. You can't do it with sticks.
Right.
We also, I don't think, should be hoping for that, because if the government falls, somebody has to take over.
Yeah.
Well, who would that be? In Cuba, they have the system that has sort of kept dissidents. There are dissidents. People who are courageous enough to speak out, and they get punished for it all the time, but they're kept in bubbles. So there are individual groups here, there, and in Santiago and Havana and some other part, but none of them have a real network. There's no single leader. There's no Lech Walesa. Right. In fact, there's no Fidel Castro anywhere. The strongest groups are in your backyard.
Uh-huh.
Now, if the government falls, there's an invitation to some group there in Miami that says, we're going to go and take over, and all of a sudden you have a conflict, because the people who have lived through this for 60 years are not going to be so eager to welcome somebody who hasn't been there, who has lived with all the benefits of living in the West, coming in. So you saw in Haiti, it's very interesting, the guy that they have apprehended as mastermind for the assassination of the president was living in South Florida.
Of course.
An idea that he could go in and take over.
Wow.
Well, I think that the better thing would be, and we're starting to see it, it's just tiny. And remember, in Cuba, everything is so, for a small country, outsized.
Mm-hmm.
For 60 years, it's been punching above its weight. It's bigger than it should be, more important than it should be. It's
sure.
Just a little country of 11 million people. What the prime minister said this week was, in response to the demands of the people in the street, who are not demanding an end to the embargo, nor are they demanding the overthrow of the government. They want food and medicine.
Huh.
They want somebody to listen. The prime minister said he was temporarily limits on the amount of medicine and food that Cuban Americans could bring in. I mean, right now, if you ever take a flight to Cuba, you'll see the tourist on one side and the Cuban Americans going back with their luggage stuffed with material that you can't get there. They have a limit of, I think, 50 pounds and a certain amount that you can bring in. If you bring in too many containers of coffee, they will charge you taxes or they'll confiscate it. he's now saying you can bring in as much ibuprofen or medicine or food as you want, and we'll let that go. Now, that's a tiny, tiny little concession, but it is a concession from an authoritarian government to the direct demands of people in the street. And I think that it's significant and could lead, well, hopefully, for the sake of the Cuban people, will lead to the government recognizing that they can't just blame everything on the Americans, that they have to take some responsibility for mucking up things for so long that the people are fed up.
Right. Now, I know that the policy changed from when Obama was in office to when Trump was in office, and you're saying that the Biden administration really hasn't changed anything back. They're not going back to what the Obama policy was. But what are the travel restrictions now? If I wanted to go to Cuba, could I?
You could. Yes. Okay. You could. You could go under one of the licenses that you had before, which was direct aid to the Cuban people.
Okay.
However, here's the problem. Cuba would require you, if you came in a group, say a group of people from your church, synagogue, or neighborhood, uh-huh, were coming together with a plan to help the Cuban people. And you had that license, you took a flight from Miami to Havana. In Havana, they would require you to present a negative COVID test.
Okay, good.
To take a COVID test there, mm-hmm, to then be taken to a designated hotel where you would be kept in quarantine for 5 to 7 days.
Okay.
Then take another test to wow, prove that you were still negative, and then be allowed out. The rub is that as an American, you would not be allowed to stay in, because of the Trump sanctions, any of the hotels on the list that Cuba uses for this quarantine.
Oh, how
so
interesting.
You just can't do it. So I haven't been able to go back in a year.
I see.
Because of that.
Wow. And so the Biden administration, the Biden administration is going to have to revise its guidelines, yeah, and right? I mean, something's got to change, especially with in light of the developments over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think, you know, the candidate Biden said for sure we need to reverse these, and Vice President Biden was very much a part of the Obama plan. There was a lot of criticism, and I think a lot of it rightly directed at them for doing a one-sided deal, basically re-establishing diplomatic relations, allowing American travel, all that whole suite of givebacks without getting much in return.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what they're attempting to do is to find a way of forcing this government, which is, as you rightly pointed out before, a government without a Castro in charge, at least de facto in charge. Raul is still around, and
right,
they called him out of retirement on Monday, because the other guy is so weak, to somehow to fulfill the campaign promises to restore some of those Obama openings without giving away the store a second time. And that's complicated because the Cubans may be under a lot of pressure. They may be facing unprecedented protest in the street, but they are still Cubans, which means that they're proud and they're stubborn, and they know how to tighten their belts. So the government, even this government, as weak as it is not going to just roll over and play dead. So there's some tough negotiation. I think the Biden team probably has people who can do that. Unfortunately, they're just at the beginning, and still don't have an assistant secretary of state for Western Hemisphere affairs, the guy or woman who should be in charge right now. They haven't filled that position. So it's unfortunate that all of this is happening. Cuba is important, but so is Israel, Haiti, Russia, China. I mean, you name it, COVID.
Right. COVID, Japan,
the Delta
Olympics.
Variant.
Right. Everything going on right now. There's so much, but something's got to give here in Cuba. So this is a hot spot. This is a situation we need to keep an eye on, especially down here in South Florida, for sure. We have no choice. But the rest of the country needs to as well, because a lot could change over the next few weeks, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. The Coast Guard will be watching very carefully. And I think that's the critical point right there, because history tells us that that's what they do. And that would be that would complicate not only Cuba-U.S. South Florida relations, but what do you do on the Mexican border when you've got all these people coming in, and then you've got all those Trump supporters who voted for the former president in the last election, who were already berating the Biden administration for being soft on immigration, soft on the Mexican border.
Right.
And now we're going to have a situation that possibly will bring in all of these immigrants without documents, without permissions, without visas. So a very, very delicate situation. And they don't know Díaz-Canel, the current president.
Right.
See, they have dealt with Raul before. Mm-hmm. And although Raul is pretty much a hard ass on a lot of things, he actually negotiated. He sent his son to negotiate with the Obama administration. He said many times, everything is on the table,
right,
except for Guantanamo and you know, a couple of things. But he was willing to negotiate. This guy, because of his insecurity, I think makes him more dangerous.
Huh. Okay, well,
Raul didn't have to worry because he was Raul. But this guy being insecure, not really, and based on the way he responded initially by, you know, telling everybody go out and, you know, clear the streets, what I get back from my people there is that he is a complete incompetent. And they have no faith or confidence in him.
Okay, so well, then it's a powder keg ready to burst. It sounds like, and so I guess we stay tuned. We wait and see what happens, and hope that the Biden administration is working behind the scenes to do something.
Keep an eye on the water.
Keep an eye on the water. Okay, well, we'll do that. Anthony DePalma, I hope as things develop, you'll come back and keep us posted on what's happening, because this is history in the making.
It is indeed, and I'd be glad to help in any way I can.
Terrific. Thank you so much for your time today. Again, the book is The Cubans, Ordinary Lives in Extraordinary Times, and I'll post links to that and your op-ed for The Washington Post on the blog along with today's interview. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to meet you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Take care.
You too. There you go. Anthony DePalma. Interesting. And it's interesting reading the chat room. So we have somebody in the chat named Jeffrey. And let me just... So Jeffrey is obviously not in South Florida. He just wrote, I have nothing but respect for the Castros and their resistance to the corrupting influence of the corporate state. Jeffrey, if you could talk to some people who escaped from Cuba, people who have family still there, you might be singing a little bit of a different song. Just saying. That said, look, I hope the Cuban people can take care of this themselves. It shouldn't be our problem, but because they are 90 miles from us, it is. And when they do, if they do open the borders again, if they do open the waters and tens of thousands of people get on rafts and start coming here, it is going to have a huge impact, a huge impact. The Castros were not good people, not good people. Not saying that we know best for the Cuban people, but freedom would be nice. Access to food and jobs and money and, you know, the niceties in life. Electricity would be nice. Don't be, you know, saying, oh, Castro's a hero here, because you're wrong. You're just wrong. All right. We've got a few minutes left. And what I want to talk to you about, it's not funny. I'm laughing. Maybe it's a nervous laugh. But COVID is rearing its ugly head again. And, you know, there are some of us, hello, who thought that they states were opening up too quickly. I'm glad people were getting vaccinated, but as we've learned, not enough are. And it's not good. So here, you know what? I'm not going to play that because that takes too long. Let me share with you a little bit of hypocrisy, because you understand hypocrisy. The Republicans, you remember, Donald Trump, I don't think he deserves any credit for anything, but he was insistent on, you know, trying to develop a vaccine quickly rather than, you know, taking the normal time, right? So I want you to hear, there's a compilation, the Washington Post put this video together, just runs about 2 minutes, but it's Republicans talking about the vaccine when Trump was in office and when Biden was in office. Big difference between the two. So it starts with Mitch McConnell. Oh, hold on. Let me turn this one down. Otherwise, we're going to get feedback. Okay. Here we go.
As a result of Operation Warp Speed.
Whoops. Now it's not playing. Hold on. Maybe I do
two,
need to do this.
But three highly effective vaccines.
No. Okay. Hold on. You have no audio. I'm going to start it over. Hold on a second. I know you have no audio. Give me 1 second. Bear with me. Audio coming. I promise you. Audio coming. Chatters. I know. No sound. It's coming. I'm moving slowly, but it is coming. All right. Audio back. It's back now. Okay, so let's start this over again. So now you'll have audio. Here we go. And now I need to take the echo away. You know, it was going so smoothly, right? Okay, here we go again. Audio should be back. Here we go.
As a result of Operation Warp Speed, not one, not two, but three highly effective vaccines. And so I'm perplexed by the difficulty we have in finishing the job. If you're a football fan, we're in the
red zone, but we're not in the end zone yet. What happened here?
President Trump deserves a lot of credit to produce a vaccine while it was being tested and approved. So now once it's approved, it can start
Ron
shipping
Johnson.
Immediately. So that was a brilliant operation from my standpoint. And I hope it is as safe and effective as it certainly seems to be.
We are all pro-vaccine. But again, just because the vaccine is generally safe doesn't mean that it's 100% safe.
Hey, Ron Johnson,
I
before and after.
To building up that herd immunity. And so I'm going to do the responsible thing. You know, I'm probably going to get the vaccine and move on. So I'm not opposed to it.
Let's not lose sight of the fact that this is still an experimental vaccine being used under emergency use authorization. The federal government does not have the right to tell Americans that they have to get this vaccine. And it's none of their business who's had it and who hasn't had it.
Operation Warp Seed.
This is Ralph Norman of South Carolina. A congressman
from the start to the finish on a vaccine. Now we've done it in less than 12 months. It's amazing.
There are a lot of people who don't believe in a vaccine. That's called personal freedom. That's called their right to choose to get a vaccine versus not get a vaccine.
Operation Warp Speed. It worked at warp speed. Not one, but two promising vaccine candidates, both over 95% effective.
I've been vaccinated. I'm told that I am now safe from getting this. This is ripples well down the chain, because right now you have schools saying, can they make a segment of the population that is barely affected by this get vaccines that we don't even know the long-term effects of?
The one thing that could save us
is Rand Paul.
Really help us, and that's
listen
the vaccine.
To Rand Paul.
I've been a big proponent of releasing it early. I think that we've had enough safety and effectiveness.
This
data.
Is before.
And as soon as we get the vaccine, we're going to get out of this in a rapid fashion. And all I would say to government officials is let's get the vaccine out as
wow.
soon as we can.
Rand
Some of
Paul.
Both had the disease and the vaccine, but we should study that also because we would want to know, is the vaccine more dangerous or are you more likely to have serious side effects? And one dose may be enough, but also maybe zero doses is enough.
Yeah, maybe zero doses is enough. These people are just such fucking hypocrites. So that production, courtesy of the Washington Post, showing the hypocrisy of these Republicans. When Trump was in office, yeah, vaccine, baby, let's get them going fast. And now that Trump is no longer in office, oh, you don't need a vaccine. The government is making you do this. They're implanting stuff in your, things in your arms. Give me a break. Here's a Biden today. He did chopper talk today. If I can pull this up very quickly. Hold on 1 second. It's running sluggishly today. So Joe Biden was headed toward, I guess, the helicopter, and the media is there by the helicopters, and so they shouted questions at him, and, well, and he obliged.
On COVID misinformation, what's your message to platforms like Facebook?
They're killing people.
They're killing people.
I mean, it really, look, the only pandemic we have is among the unvaccinated. And they're killing people.
And that was it. Short and sweet. They're killing people. I mean, what more can you say? Then there was the piece. Oh, my God. Do I have this? I don't know if I have this video or not. Jen Psaki. She's got the patience of a saint. I do have it. All right. So Peter Ducey. That's how his name should be pronounced. Peter Ducey is the Fox guy. Listen to this.
For how long has the administration been spying on people's Facebook profiles looking for vaccine misinformation?
Well, that was quite a loaded and inaccurate question, which I would refute. Well, Peter, first of all, as you know, we're in a regular touch with a range of media outlets.
How long have the administration been spying on people's Facebook?
As we are in regular touch with social media platforms. This is publicly open information, people sharing information online, just as you are all reporting information on your news stations.
Okay, so these 12 people who you have on a list, 12 individuals, do they know that somebody at the Surgeon General's office is going through their profile?
I'm happy to get you the citation of where that comes from. There's no secret list. I will tell you that these are people who are sharing information on public platforms on Facebook, information that is traveling, is inaccurate. Our biggest concern here, and I frankly think it should be your biggest concern, is the number of people who are dying around the country because they're getting misinformation that is leading them to not take a vaccine.
But
young people, old people, kids, children, this is all being, a lot of them are being impacted by misinformation.
The big concern, though, I think, for a lot of people on Facebook is that now this is Big Brother watching you.
Oh, my God.
They're more concerned about that than people dying across the country because of a pandemic where misinformation is traveling on social media platforms. That feels unlikely to me. If you have the data to back that up, I'm happy to discuss it.
About things that are on Facebook, I looked this morning. There are videos of Dr. Fauci from 2020.
You know what? I'm going to get rid of him just because he's just so damn annoying. So Steve Ducey is, that's how we pronounce his name from now on. By the way, did you hear the news this morning? Casey Hunt. That's her, Casey Hunt from MSNBC announced she's leaving. And there was like question. She didn't say where she was going. She said she'd announce it in a couple of weeks. And then Variety broke the story. She's going to CNN to help them with their streaming stuff. And they're paying her. Are you sitting down? They're paying her between $1 million and $1.5 million a year. Casey Hunt, really? I mean, good for her, but really? I'm a little stunned, frankly, because wow. Anyway, I don't get it, but more power to her. And if it means that CNN is going to step up their streaming, that'd be great, because in my bedroom, I can't get CNN. It will not, and I have the streaming TV. Anyway, I digress. So we're talking about COVID, and Los Angeles County now, mask mandate back in effect. But Monday, London, I think all of England, the lockdown is lifted, which I don't think that's going to last very long. Boris Johnson the other day said something along the lines of, we're just going to have to learn to live with COVID. Actually, I think it goes, you're going to have to learn to die with COVID. I don't think he's going to be able to do it, but here's how, you don't know who Casey Hunt is. She's a reporter for NBC News and MSNBC. She's like their lead congressional correspondent. But she's young. And I have a thing about Casey Hunt because back in 2016, during the campaign, we went to see Bernie Sanders at a rally in Miami. And we were in the press riser because I'm press. And we were seated on a riser directly in front of the stage where all the cameras were, and directly in front of Casey Hunt, who was not paying attention to Bernie Sanders. All she was doing was primping, putting on makeup, checking her look in the monitor, doing the lipstick and the hair and the makeup again and looking again. Had no interest in what Bernie was doing on stage. Her back was turned to the stage. So that's my Casey Hunt thing. But, you know, anyway, more power to her. All right. So we are just moments away from the weekend. So with the lockdown, lockdown being lifted in England, and I don't think it's going to last very long, our favorite, you notice how I include you in this, our favorite singing family, the Marsh family, has a new song, and I thought we'd end the week with it because they're so good. I interviewed this family a few months ago. You can find it on my YouTube channel because they're just so adorable. There's four kids and two parents. Both parents are, I believe, professors. They're teachers. None of them are professional musicians, but they all sing and play instruments. And anyway, I thought you would get a kick out of this because they're singing about the end of lockdown world. The problem is, I don't think it's really the end. But yeah, for now, for them, as of Monday, it will be. So enjoy the Marsh family and lockdown world. Here we go. Take it away. Marsh family singers. I think they're this millennium's answer to the Von Trapp family singers. Here we go. I think.
Must be fine if you call in a lockdown.
It is the Marsh family with Lockdown World, as the lockdown is ending this weekend in England. All right. And with that, we come to the end of another week. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great weekend. I'll see you Monday. Wear a mask. Stay safe. Bye, everyone.